Welcome to the Forensic Happy Hour. It's 2022. Took a little break on doing some of the podcasts. I would say got a little busy, and then I was told we need to start doing this again because they are fun. Obviously, we get people in the industry, several different industries. Obviously, we had from last year, from the cybersecurity side of it, from the digital forensic side of it. So it was nice. The IR side of it. So we'll continue to do that. I'm looking forward to getting additional guests, continuing on doing the Forensic Happy Hour because people kind of like it. So I guess that's a good thing at times. So without further ado, I have Matt Turner, who is going to be the numero uno guest of 2022 to give us a little bit. I think some fireworks for 2022. I can feel it. I think that is going to be an exciting show. So what I do is I say, hey, cheers to the guests. Give you just a little cheers. Thank you. And we'll begin it with, Matt, give the people a little background of your life starting, when you're a baby, I guess, or however. What got you into doing what you're doing now, and tell us a little bit more about yourself.
Hey, we have to start a little bit later than that.
Okay.
For me, let's go back to age six. No, my dad actually introduced me to a visual book on DOS 6, and in each case in my life, it's been troubleshooting and learning how things work. So at the age of six, it was I would sit on my dad's lap and we would go through MS-DOS, and it was me trying to get ahead of myself in the book while he was at work that I was almost formatted his hard drive. And I was looking through the book just before this call, and I realized the author was smart enough to use the mapping for the B drive and not the C drive, which case I had taken the adaption of the book and relative to the directory I was, because there wasn't a B drive, and tried formatting the C drive. For me, analytical mindset and the leap to understand was something that I always wanted to do. And whether it was playing hub LAN games with my siblings over IPX at the time, which is a novel technology before we had TCP/IP, and just playing WAN games over I think it was a 9600 baud modem.
Makes that sound.
So, yeah. So breaking the bezel on my compact laptop, I got to repair that entirely. And built my own computer, fried it through an unmonitored 2-pin fan. Lost my data by frying a USB drive through an ungrounded USB port. And over 10 years ago, I was working for a company that I was introduced to migrating their websites. So we would take their websites and migrate them over to our hosting provider. And I was doing this client by client. And this last client, I had migrated their domain over, and the very next day I get a ticket, and that ticket says their email's down. And as I'm driving on site, I'm going, this site sounds very familiar. And that was a very hard lesson about what an MX record was, what Exchange was, and more importantly, the importance of time to live. So, it doesn't have to be digital forensics or cybersecurity for us to kind of pick up that analytical nature, but it's through our failures and through the problems that we encounter that we learn the most. I taught for 3 years at the associate level, teaching students about networking, but more importantly, teaching them how to troubleshoot and not trust anything. I don't want to sound maniacal here, but I would purposely sabotage the labs.
See, you can get a laugh, though. Give us that laugh. Exactly.
No, I would make a small cut into the network cable, and I would provide some network cables that they didn't make. So they would be forced to make their own cables, test their own cables, and then there would be a few cables for them to connect the switch to the patch panel. And those cables weren't all working. So they, same thing with lab instructions. We have a default, and this is especially true in non-cybersecurity, that things are written very theoretical. And we teach ourselves to follow the steps, but when we can't follow the steps, we have to ask ourselves why. And it's coming across those hurdles that we're forcing ourselves to ask the hard questions and try to think of the situation and where we're at. If there's anybody who knows how to is familiar with Vim or VI, you know that if those that are not familiar with it have a difficult time getting out of it, because
so when we use acronyms on the show, because yes, obviously you have people that aren't necessarily, you know, in the know, you know what, build on that. So explain to people, give them kind of that that information. We can be educational.
Oh, sure. So Vim is VI improved, but Vim is a text-based editor that's in Linux, and it allows you to edit a config file or a text file that you're changing and commit those changes. So instead of just closing out, it has an insert mode and it has an administrative mode that you have to toggle between, and then perform a command colon WQ for write and quit. But if you're not familiar with the commands, then it's
just like almost formatting a C drive, and lucky you did the B drive, right?
Oh, I tried the C drive. My dad changed the drive letter. A day
Smart.
Before.
Smart man.
So, yes.
Anyway, so continue to go on. I mean, you're teaching students. You're kind of giving them kind of the real world of this is what's going to happen. You know,
yep.
It's like the first steps of, hey, why isn't it working? Have you first checked the cable? So continue on and a little bit more of those that you gave to some of your students.
Sure. So, maybe not at the student level. Let me.
Just progressing on of how that information, the, you know, obviously took you out of that into, you know, either your digital forensic side of it, cybersecurity. Give us a little bit of information on that.
Yeah. So I was, at the same time I was teaching, I was transitioning from system administration into the cybersecurity side. And I remember back at, this is going back a little ways, but there was a convention called Not a Con that had a diverse amount of speakers, and I was being introduced to cybersecurity as well at the time. And I remember lunch hour came around, and I got to join one of the speakers and his team to lunch. And I kind of used the opportunity to sit down and talk to them about, how do I enter cybersecurity? Where do I need to go? And it was kind of the conversation of, well, what are you majoring in? Well, I'm majoring in information system security. Oh, that's a specialization. I hate it when colleges do that. It's like, oh, great. I'm behind the eight ball already. And he said, don't be surprised if you have to pick up system administration and learn how to walk before you can run. Before you go into cybersecurity, don't be surprised if you have to learn how things work and do that system administration background before you can jump in. I did that. And I understand why that is so important, because if you don't understand how things work, how can you protect them? So the my transition from came from field technician to system administration to working in a library doing system specialization, so network system, some back-end database for some custom things, and then transitioning over to system administration position in a security operations group.
So let me ask you something, Matt. So is and I mean, it's kind of a theme really throughout all the shows that I've done is really kind of the foundation, right? So foundational, I mean, we're talking at the cable level, right? We're talking about how do you go and you're going to put this patch cable, or you're going to put a network cable. How are you going to do this? How important is that in one, your education, and then those who might be getting into the field? You know, because I think a lot of people, as you had mentioned, wants to run before they walk, right? But that's obviously opposite. But how important is that to really understand those foundations?
Yeah, it's very important to understand how things work. I mentioned that's you can better protect it, but also something that's not fundamentally taught very well is to document those steps as you go through. And in doing so, you can not only learn from your mistakes, but anybody that encounters a situation similar to yours can also grow and learn from that too.
So right now it's a commercial break for Matt Turner's GitHub repository, because you do have a log. So DFIR log, you can go and just search your name, right? And you have a repository for it.
That was just a project that I recently stood up. DFIR logbook is a simple tool right now that just allows you to input text and produce an output as you're going. The intent, when I worked incident digital forensics, incident response, I consistently interfaced with the SOC or my peers, or from a discovery perspective, you encounter situations that don't look bad, may possibly be bad, or it could be very bad. So the as you're working through a case or working through an incident, you that timeline changes, and the perspectives or the actions that you take are constantly moving, and it can be very fast-paced. So it's important that you document your steps and your actions as they happen. Otherwise, it would be much, much more painful if you have to recall those, either from an internal perspective or for an external party, what took place.
Yeah, it just goes back to, I mean, anything else, right? It has to be, I mean, if it can be replicated, and if you replicate it, if you have the steps that are down there, it can be, right? So, so you're able to go in and not only just justify it, but to take it that extra step of really, showing or formulating the process that you took, right?
Yeah, it
Yeah.
does.
Yeah, so onto the process. If you look at even from a cybersecurity side of it, obviously it's very, very fluid, during some sort of incident. But if you look at with the digital forensics side of it, I mean, how important is the process that you take in within any type of incident or even preparation, hardening the environment?
Yeah, it's very important. Knowing what you have and being able to understand what data you're providing is critical. I can tell you several cases where I've looked at sources or been given sources, and the times don't match make sense for the artifacts. So we can be in a situation where a case is established and a artifact or let's say an executable is noted. And that executable, if I go and look at that from a timeline perspective, I'm not seeing it. Why am I not seeing it? Well, the source artifact might not be in the right time zone that was originally defined by the initiator. Or in system forensics, what are those artifacts and how have they changed over time?
So I guess, I mean, it was really multiple disciplines, right? So you have those people that, if we're going to talk about those that are, say, protecting a network, it's kind of real time, right? So that would you say that's a separate, really a discipline, rather than those people that, you know, are going to wind up looking at the artifacts, right? Those things that might be historical of, oh shit, all the stuff, things broke down. We've now lost millions of dollars, if we're talking on the corporate side of it. And we come in a week later to kind of find out what. I mean, are those really two disciplines?
It depends on the organization you work for.
Yeah, who's paying it, right? I guess.
So I worked in the government sector where we did the network forensics and the system forensics. So where some organizations, the network forensics is handled entirely by a different group, or the threat intel side is handled by a separate group.
How does that work? I mean, when you have multiple people in multiple groups, I mean, how good does the communication have to be between both those?
Yeah, communication and documentation is very key to making that work. And if you don't have that, then the separation of the groups just breaks down the enrichment of what you're looking at. And it's very easy to miss artifacts or miss something important.
Yeah, so we start talking about artifacts, especially on the network side of it. You know, I kind of deal in mobile phones, and, you know, I'm pretty familiar with those types of artifacts, as well as, you know, back in the day doing a lot of just kind of dead box forensics. So mm-hmm. I'm always intrigued with network, just because, you know, everything doesn't matter. If it's a home network, it doesn't matter anywhere else. There's artifacts that are laid down. But obviously, when we start talking about the large corporate side of it, So give the viewers and the people that are going to be watching that, I mean, what are some fantastic little nuggets, you know, as you're going through this of what to look for? You know, we always have the logs that you can go and jump into, you can grab stuff. But, I mean, what is the thing you're like, yeah, I need to make sure we're looking through this?
Yeah, it's not more so a thing, but I found a technique that is very useful in a lot of situations that I've worked has been frequency analysis. And that
explain that, because that sounds awesome.
So if you see an activity or alerted on an activity where a user or a process was triggered, that may be benign. It may be something that's more common in the workplace than you originally perceived. And it may lead to something that's not even an incident, it may be a false positive. Point in case, I've seen cases where antivirus has triggered on an executable, and it turns out it was just the signatures that were updated, and it's keying off of a heuristic match, not a signature match for that, and needs to be vetted out or whitelisted. I've seen cases where user activity may be suspect in nature, but has led to the discovery of a service account that was improperly configured.
Talk about that. I mean, that's kind of interesting, because obviously antivirus back in the day, especially when doing computer forensics and when the scanners that were run, obviously dates and times, modifications, all of that, those types of things of access are pretty important. But talk about the service.
About service accounts in general, or
I mean, if you're going to look, why is that important?
Yeah, so service accounts should be tied to a specific application or use that should be well defined. And cases where a service account is perform an abnormal activity, these are accounts that may have privileged access. They may be accounts, service accounts, and in historically have been accounts that have a static password. Kind of identifying the risk that service account has, identifying the owner of that account, and vetting out the services if they're not defined are all things that you have to do in an investigation.
How much more difficult does it become when you have people that are working in, you know, all over the world, right? That they have or access, whether it be VPN, however they're accessing that information. How much more difficult does it become with a worldwide workforce?
Yeah, just the fact that people are connecting over the VPN now. Versus what we've traditionally seen of people working inside the workplace has shifted the goalpost of artifacts that we would look at. So things like web activity or pairing DNS activity to what IP address they have via DHCP are all aspects that have shifted, because they're connecting through the VPN, and then from their VPN connection, they're connecting to those resources.
Yeah. So how much? I mean, how difficult is that, right? Because you know, if you just think about what with the VPN in itself, with you know, utilizing a server to jump to another. Just simple, if people think about, you know, hey, yeah, I've been utilizing VPNs and using them for years, is typically used to mask, you know, obviously your IP, you know, keep it away from web traffic, do whatever of all these crawlers. But now it's pretty common place for companies to initialize some sort of tunneling to allow them to do that. So how does that, again, you said shift the goalpost. I mean, does it make it more difficult to, I mean, as you say, additional artifacts make it more difficult to do, you know, some sort of examination on it?
Yeah. I mean, it can make it slower.
Yeah.
You're connecting over the, I mean, if we have a user in Alaska, then good luck with the Alaskan residential internet connection they have. The ability to collect artifacts has shifted from just like system forensics has shifted from doing full disk collections, triage collections become even more important, and keying in on the artifacts that we need to becomes even more important.
Isn't that interesting? I mean, 20 years ago when I'm doing computer forensics, it's like, boom, pull the plug on it, go and do and just completely image this drive, and now just look through all this stuff with, you know, 1.6 with Incase, or, you know what, you're going to look in these FTK. I mean, that was, I mean, that put a lot of gray hairs on my head just because of the sheer amount of data of, like, you know, 512, you know, or a 1 gig. You know, now we're talking terabytes and terabytes of data. So I think that obviously the shift to the triage is not going to go anywhere, right? And so let's talk about the problems that you might foresee on the triage side of it. Because obviously if you're saying, okay, I now have, I don't want to say preconceived, but I'll say preconceived notion of what I'm going to look for. So now I'm going to deploy this to what I believe should be there or what I want to target.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm going to pull that stuff off. Right. So obviously there's inherent risk to that. Would you agree?
Yeah, there is. And certain artifacts on a laptop or workstation aren't necessary because of the volume collected or ingested into a centralized log collection, like a SIEM is. So
yeah, because, you know, obviously a lot of the companies who are either utilizing those types of tools, and especially with endpoint and endpoint collection, that they either have those things in different type of triggers, but a lot of companies don't have that. One, they can't afford it, you know, and so if there is some sort of an event, maybe they have a service provider that comes in and is going to wind up doing the investigation to that. A lot of them, you know, especially, they're not going to do a full collection on that. They're going to say, all right, okay, company, what is it that you believe occurred or what did occur? And then you as the investigator are going to have to formulate a plan of what you're going to target, right?
Yeah.
So does that make things, I guess, I don't want to... To me, I think that there can be an issue with that, right? Is because if I go in and I do a targeted collection, I'm going to go and grab this information, and then I'm like, okay, oh crap, I think I need to go and get that stuff, and it's gone, right? So
yeah.
So I guess give me your opinion on, you know, and obviously we can't go and grab terabytes and terabytes and terabytes of information on that, but as we've shifted to kind of the triage, and really a lot of tools have really shifted to the triage method, does it make us lazy?
It does not. It makes us it makes us more surgical.
I like that.
We're being more precise about what we need to collect, and it makes us more agile to situations. And we have to be more agile. But more importantly, we have to set the baseline for expectations. And if we're internal to the organization, send those baselines. There's several external parties that help us define those baselines. So CI Security, for example, provides some very nice baselines for businesses and allows us to establish important artifacts that on a system need to be configured or tailored from the default that definitely aid us in an investigation.
So let me just add to that, right? So a human being formulates, these are the artifacts that you should have. But you know, like there's how often do artifacts either change or we have new unique artifacts? So how often do those things have to be updated?
Yeah. Right. Windows 10 introduced the shift from saying Service Pack 1, Service Pack 2, and yeah, so, we have version numbers now that are subsets.
Yep. Yep, exactly right. And you know, it's a full-time job to update those. Harlan Carvey, who I've had on the show, right? He's done a lot of you know, with especially Windows with their forensics, those types of items. And I mean, it's a full-time job. And it's just like anything else with artifacts on any type of device, any type of digital device, anything that holds zeros and ones, is that it continually changes. Either for security reasons, right? But if security reasons, they're going to add additional items that might be on that, right? Yeah. So obviously, how important is it for people to continue on with their education and trying to get and to work and to get more competent to understand that? Because you can't just kind of wing it anymore, right?
No. Yeah, it's a continual process. Outside of work, I have a personal lab that I have set up to just test different OSs and test different artifacts. So it's we're in a fortunate field that there's a very sharing community, but it's on us to take that information and apply it to the organizations or to the work environment that we're part of. So if we're not testing it, who is? And not everything is captured in a tool.
Yeah. And I think that is a huge, huge point. Let me just talk about a couple of things. One, you answered the question correctly about the full image versus the triage, because I think that in itself gets you that gold star, right? Remember in kindergarten or something, you get a gold star or multiple gold stars, because I think that the point that you made about people understanding, right, these artifacts that we're going to go after, because the full disk doesn't mean anything if you don't know what to do with it, right? Mm-hmm. I'm going to go and take all this information. But if one, you have an understanding of the event, you have an understanding of those artifacts that you're going to be hunting, that you're going to be locating, you're going to be going after, again, surgically, because I love that, is far more, I don't want to say even important, I think that it's a better examination at that point, right? So that you are getting a clear picture. There's always outliers, right? There's always outliers that this guy had some portable apps that were installed, and I mean, you have these things and he has them on a thumb drive. I mean, there's all those, right? You can always go in and say there's these outliers. But for the most part, you know, people are human and they do what they do. But, you know, you have that the information that's there, and as long as you can go and collect that information but be very competent in that. And I think that there's more competent people now because, like you said, you know, the industry, not necessarily the industry, but really the people that are involved into this are way more helpful, and they get it. They get it that, one, tools aren't going to support everything, ever, yep. Ever, right? Because there are new things that come out. I mean, even if they support it, it's not supported because the version just changed, because either you have a database changes or you have different type of schemes. So it's never – so those people that really think that you can just go and push a button, that day is – I mean, that ship has sailed, right?
Yeah. As things have become more complicated, the human aspect has become even more important. I know Harlan kind of touched on the importance of communication. And I'll say starting before this field – I was identified by outside people as the probably not the person that you have customer facing. So that's changed a lot, and it's directly impacted how adept and capable I can be in my field. So many situations I've picked up the phone and had that conversation with the individual on the other side, and we're talking the matter of seconds to identify or home in on where to go next in my investigation, to instead of spanning the whole field.
Why'd you click on that file that ended in a BAT? Why?
Right.
And what did it do? And where is it?
Was there something suspicious?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No. I think that's extremely important, right? That we look at because honestly, you know, as you look at the field, you know, and people who are trying to get into either cyber, well, for the most part, cybersecurity that you have, I mean, the sky's the limit, right? But people can't just go and sign up and say, hey, you know what? I have a cybersecurity degree because I got it here and I'm ready to go.
Yep.
Right. It's school of hard knocks. So, you know, honestly, if I'm going to go in and talk to someone about, you know, hey, I'm going to hire you to, you know, as part of with the network stuff, give me a little bit more about you. Well, yeah, no, I have my degree and I did this. No. Tell me about DOS. Right. Tell me how you know, your dad gave you a book with DOS. You know, tell me about you opening up a floppy drive, you know, over a network on somebody else's, and you guys thought it was hilarious and funny. You know, tell me those are the types of things, because there's a lot of thinking on your feet. Would you agree? I mean, you can go into a situation like, oh man, okay, and think about it that way instead of just saying, okay, let me go to page 4 of this and I learned that.
Yeah, it is. Trust but verify comes up often. I especially when you're first starting off as an analyst, everything looks bad. And the importance to maintain perspective and not only bounce things off of your peers, but really question for yourself why things work the way they work, and will help validate your opinion of a situation. It's keeping things in perspective and making sure you're communicating with your peers as well as documenting it.
So you talked about expectations. Mm-hmm. You know, so how important is it to set expectations for either your, you know, your teammates, expectations on a job, but you know, also with those clients that you might be interfacing with? How important is it to really be honest and set those expectations?
Yeah, it's very important, and it's also important to ensure that you understand the expectations of the stakeholder. So things that make sense to us, such as putting everything into UTC time, might not make sense to somebody in HR or legal. You have to maintain the perspective of the stakeholder audience that you're providing those reports to. Sometimes we are the technical people for a situation, and the technical aspects are not captured by the requester. So we can have situations where I need an activity report and I want you to provide me user login, logout activity. Okay. Well, describing additional artifacts can help guide the search parameters to the actual formalized request. Are there emails sent that describe the activity that you're looking for? Are there VPN logs that describe the activity you're looking for? Are there specific systems that we should be looking at? These are systems that we've identified. So providing the technical descriptive nature of a request can help formalize that the aspects to the actual signed off request that we need to work.
Mm-hmm. And so I guess kind of elaborating a little bit more on that for me is, I mean, do you have documented, SOPs that you guys utilize, you know, that you're utilizing with your customer so that the one they understand? Because I like the UTC thing, because people are like, really, what? I'm in the United States and I know inches and I know miles and I know Fahrenheit, you know, which is way different than anything else. And it's so I guess what the importance to communicate, right? To communicate to communicate to them. I mean, that that to me is setting expectations as well as helping them understand what you're doing.
Yes.
Is probably the most important thing, right? Because if they don't understand, one, what you're doing, they and they assume what you're doing, and when they assume what they're doing, they're going to be wrong.
Yes.
Right. So I mean, do you as well as your team members, or do you have someone in the group that is actually is handling these expectations? How do you set this stuff up?
Yeah. Standard operating procedures are a formal way to identify those and make sure it's repetitive between the team members. And the key here is consistency, so that we all understand and perform the same process. We all treat the situation in the same manner. And if there's aspects that we need to learn and grow from, that those are captured and then baked back into the standard operating procedure.
Mm-hmm. So it's always, it's a living document.
It is. Yeah.
Yeah.
Speaking for mobile phones, for example, you can have external characteristics such as the MDM solution, which is the managed
mobile device management.
Thank you. The mobile device management that is on the device that handles those the technical control aspects of the policy that you have. So if those change, or if the MDM solution changes, or it evolves over time, that you can stay lockstep in with your standard operating procedure to the handling of that.
Now I'm going to ask you a question. So MDMs, obviously, if I have I'm managing, say for a company, right? But I have a bring your own device policy, but I also have them attached to the MDM. How's that going?
Containerization is a good concept.
Yes, but what happens outside the container? Do you have access to that?
That is a good question.
Exactly, because I'm telling you, it is every time, you know, I go and I talk to, you know, companies, I'm like, hey, yeah, you got your MDM that you're using. Like, yeah, man, fantastic. We got everything we got going on. Anything we know, visibility. I'm like, all right, well, I mean, do you actually distro all these phones to everyone with the software with the MDM on it? They're like, yeah. No, we have, you know, we do some of the executives, you know, we give them the phones, but we also have, you know, our MDM, because they're utilizing it on their cell phones, but their own cell phones, because man, that's going to cost a lot of money to do that. I'm like, oh, cool. So how do you see anything outside of that? No. We just worry about what they're doing, you know, that's within the container, whether it be the company email or the company documents that, you know, whether you Dropbox, that's all we care about. Oh, okay. So you don't care about the WhatsApp, they're sending pictures of your IP. You don't care about all this other stuff. It's amazing, because all of a sudden their head just explodes. They're like, wait, what?
Yeah.
So I mean, you're kind of in that, and you have to deal with that. So how do you go and explain to the executive, the C-level person, dude, this is probably not good, because this is what we have.
Yeah. Whether it be we're talking about the VPN, or we're talking about mobile phones, or we're talking something else, it's what information have we requested in the past, and is that captured in your new solution? So if we're talking mobile phones, well, have you been collecting text messages all this time? Are you going to collect? Do you have the authority to collect text messages now? Why would a user use an unapproved messaging solution? Well,
why would they ever do that? Why would they do
easy,
that?
It's their behavior. If somebody always uses WhatsApp, and the other person always uses WhatsApp, they might be using WhatsApp. Is that something that you want to capture? Maybe. These are all aspects. And just like when I would do incident response related behavior, the question always came up, and even more so with the VPN, because when something is blocked and it's malicious in nature, I clicked on the email, it's not working. What does the user receive? A blank white page.
I
Why
kept
isn't this
clicking,
working? I
clicking
clicked
over and
on it.
over.
I clicked on it. So do you close out the investigation saying activity was blocked? It's okay. Or do you actually identify the system activity on the system and have that communication with the user, validating the user's conversation with the technical artifacts to say, you did not disconnect from the VPN and it worked successfully
Wow, weird.
after you disconnected from the work network.
So question on that before you go on is how important is it? Obviously, you see this information, you have this information. How is that to now go in and say transition to an educational side of it, that you have recommendations on an educational side of it to say, hey, guys, you know what? When it says, hey, I just need to talk about your salary from the CFO. And you click on that PDF. I mean, how do you go in and once you're saying, yeah, it was blocked and we know this was a bad deal, how, I mean, do you then identify, hey, we need to have a training program? Do you go, how does that, how does that go and move?
So this kind of conversation kind of has presented itself in different ways, but it's kind of the mentality that we need to make things relatable. So whether we're talking in a training session, educational setting, a user setting, we need to make it relatable. And people understand their personal impact versus the work impact. So I'm trying to think of a good example, but it's important that we make situations relatable to those individuals so that it's meaningful.
Yeah, I mean that's it, it's again, I mean the and I've said it over and over on all these shows is that obviously the weakest link is that person that's sitting at the keyboard, right? Or using that mobile phone or anything else. And it's
Sure.
changing behavior if, how do you do that, and especially if people are working remotely or bringing their own device and everything else. How do you go and do that without taking some of their liberties away, right? Okay, say, hey, you can't come into the building or you can't use the our VPN on with your mobile device unless you sign this policy stating that we're going to be able to search your entire device. A lot of people are like, wait, what? So I mean, it becomes pretty difficult. It becomes really, really difficult because now you're now controlling on. Sorry, so you can't use a computer ever, and so it's that's. I feel for, especially people who are doing cybersecurity, because you are competing, not competing. You are having to deal with, you're hard in the network, fantastic, you got that, but now you got this person that's behind the keyboard going, oh, I need to hit the PDF, or hey, it's just, I'm telling you, I would be so stressed out.
The variety of options available to people is incredible. And between the shift of working from home to just the technologies that have been historically employed and then added on with other technologies and then overlapping technologies, has just made it much more difficult.
Oh yeah, you know what? That the thing that I actually talked about it a few months ago was with VR stuff, right? The huge, huge push for VR, and a lot of companies are actually moving to do VR for training. I
Sure.
mean, and I'm telling you, I'm like going, this is a gold mine. I mean, a gold mine of data. But people are like, why? Why would that be? And you're like, oh, are you kidding me? Have you actually utilized some of these? Because it's insane. It's insane. And I mean, that's just another, I guess, another device that's going to be huge. Huge when you start talking about, because they're all hooked. They're all hooked to a network, right? They're all hooked to a network. Malicious things. I mean, it's going to be crazy.
Yeah. That would be interesting.
No. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, there was an ad I was listening to. It was like, hey, you know what? Don't worry about it because all our training classes are, you can do at your home. We'll ship these VR glasses to you. You know, we have those. You can sit in a virtual classroom with the rest of the students. And you just have your own little avatar and just hang out and just do it. It's just amazing to me. But I guess, you know, the sick part about it is that you look at it and you're like, that's pretty good job security. What do you think?
There's a lot of research going into trying to figure out engagement outside of the classroom. So I'd be interested to see where that takes us. Because I know engagement is difficult in virtual settings.
No, the interesting thing about it is there was more, if we want to talk about engagement, with, say, virtual conferences. Even hybrid conferences this last year. So they were virtual as well as you can be there in person. I mean, SANS is a clear, their event, the summit, is a clear, of those who virtual, hybrid. They just, we're talking 10,000 virtual people are there.
Yeah.
And they had more engagement of actually people asking questions of those speakers from the virtual people than they were that they were actually there. Because, you know, if
that's,
you go to a conference, yeah, you know, you're sitting back and you're like, oh, I'm not going to say anything because I don't want to be stupid. You know what? Virtual people are like going, come on, I'll ask a question. You don't know who I am, you know? And so, again, it's transitioned to the whole anonymity where people are like, hey, I feel more comfortable being virtual. And now we have these VR things that people, I'm telling you, I think that there's going to be a lot more engagement.
Yeah, no, I participated in Cactus Con 9 and 10 last year and this year, and they were pretty phenomenal online. So
yeah, no, I'm telling you, it's not going to go away. I promise you, people will continue to do that. They'll have virtual, they'll be in person and everything. So I think that honestly, there'll be more engagement with those people who are not there to those that are, say, at the event, I think, which is good, right? Good for the industry. It gets more exposure to that. It allows people to ask questions of those people that might be speaking and bringing that stuff together or bringing that information out. So what, and you know what, I always say I'm not going to keep people very long, but like I told you before the show that I usually talk a lot. So the interesting thing is give everyone just kind of a breakdown. I mean, A, B, C, D, there's never that obviously, but if you're going to do, if you're responding to either event, if you want to talk about incident response or you want to talk about network security, it's whatever you want to talk about. But give people an idea of really a kind of a day-to-day. Or, you know, this is what we're going to do on first day. Company A is a startup, and you go in there. What do you need to help them out with?
Understanding their inventory, what they have. It's as simple as that, as the first steps, because if you don't know what you have, how can you protect it? And
say
it's
they have
very easy.
50 computers. They have 50 computers that are all within the same area. It's a building. They have 50 computers, 50 employees that they have there. They have a couple Synology servers, that are kind of set up. What do you need to go in to do to make sure? You're working there. How are you going to help harden that?
What needs to talk to what? And start focusing that down to technical controls and formulating that into specific profiles. so that you can go from policy to those technical controls. And as operating systems change or as those environments change, you can update and adapt your profiles to those situations.
Okay.
When there were, so in an environment that I worked in, there's major change and minor change. So where a major change has to do with key aspects of an environment changing and requiring a more holistic review, such as if I wanted to move a virtual machine that's always been internal to a to an externally facing environment.
So you brought me up to, but man, I really, we don't have a lot of time, but I'm going to ask you this question anyway. How, I guess, what's the percentage of companies that are, well, now let's just don't, I'm not, nope, not that question. The question is this. The question is it more difficult to do or respond to or digital forensics on, say, a virtual machine versus a standard computer with a spinning disk, and they're not spinning anymore as SSD.
I think they, for the most part, those are different environments. So either user facing environments are usually the physical spin and disk or solid state drive that is has a varying location versus the probably easier to pull and to analyze virtual machines because you can snapshot the state, both memory and the disk, and analyze that versus if you did holistic in a similar nature, it would be much more difficult from a user perspective.
Yeah, so with the VM, would you say that a lot of companies are actually utilizing the virtual environment within the cloud?
Yeah, they are. I would say it's still hybrid right now. We'll see where that goes going forward. But yeah,
So would you,
Microsoft's kind of
yeah, with Azure and everything else, and I mean they're really pushing out a lot of these, especially with, I mean, workplaces was a, you know, kind of a kind of the first, but we've always been dealing with VMware and, you know, all those others, but now within the cloud, right? Completely different. So would you say that conducting those types of examinations, because they're a lot more controlled, are a safer bet for a company rather than just, you know, the standard run-of-the-mill Dell that's running in their office.
Safer. We're not considering some cost aspects. It can be much safer. It goes back to how you're controlling the environment, how you're setting things up, what needs to talk to what, and formulating those good controls, those good questions early on to help make sure that things are configured how they need to be.
Yeah, I think that's extremely important that people, that one, with the questions that you lay that stuff out of, and setting up kind of the architecture that they'll need based upon not only their needs, but really what kind of security are they looking to have at that particular, either, you know, brick and mortar or remote. Everything's remote now, and being able to have that, you know, for them, that's extremely important. So how would you say, I guess we'll end it with this. I mean, how, for those people that might be trying to get into this, I mean, what are some suggestions that you would have for them when they're starting out? You know, I mean, they're getting ready to go to university, or, you know, what are kind of some steps to, I mean, quickly, what you think that, you know, that they should take so that they can get into this, get into this business?
Test things for yourself. Don't be afraid to make those questions and formulate them against yourself to understand the artifacts. if whether it be a system artifact, network artifact, or cloud artifact, those are all areas that you can work on personally to better yourself professionally. And find in those opportunities, take them in bite-sized chunks, but ask yourself the question and try to formulate that question into an answer for yourself and document that, because in doing so, you're going to understand those bits and pieces and more holistically understand situations as they occur. And I really appreciate capture the flag exercises or scenario driven approaches that kind of help bring around circle those artifacts into a situation that you might deal with.
Yeah, I think that's really important. I mean, there's a lot of CTF stuff that's going to be coming out. I mean, several companies that have that. And I think that's extremely important because practical exercises, you know, thinking back in the day, way back, you know, obviously when I was in university, but, you know, thinking about that, the practical exercises are really something that I agree. I mean, they solidify, because you can sit and read a book or have someone lecture to you about that, but without physically doing it or actually, you know, performing that, writing the code, you know, kind of getting into it yourself, it's extremely difficult to learn that way. So I do agree, making sure that you have that. So fantastic. Matt, I do appreciate it. I do. Thank you so much for hanging out with me. The number one, like I said, numero uno for 2022. And I do appreciate you hanging out.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, it is 2022. Yes, it is. Time flies when, you know, you're stuck in, you know, this thing that we're all in. But, hey, we will definitely be doing additional of the additional Forensic Happy Hours. I do make sure that you hit to follow him on Twitter, Matt E. Turner. Make sure that you get on there. Also, GitHub, download that thing, blow up GitHub, take a look at it, give him some feedback on that. That would be great. Any feedback, obviously. Anybody that's looking for to drink a beer with me, that's always good, and just talk about forensics or whatever you want to talk about, because I'll talk about dogs, cats, or anything else. But I appreciate everyone's time. Everyone have a nice weekend, a long weekend. So everyone have a good time. Be safe. Thanks.